There Is One by Gutman Lox. Part 4 of 6. 74. Consider. The Torah says that God is a jealous God. But is not jealousy a petty human trait? How can the owner of all existence be jealous? Is he afraid that we will go out with someone else? Exactly. He's afraid that we might, and therefore he warns us clearly and often not to follow after others. Going after another is in fact confessing that there is another. This is straying from the first principle. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods beside me. God will not forgive this error, and therefore is likened to a jealous person. Imagine a person whose body did not react to pain. At first, this might sound like an ideal state, pain-free living. Indeed, some disciplines recommend this as the earthly goal. But everything has its place, including pain. Pain's function is to notify the person that something must be corrected. It is a dutiful servant giving its message in the prescribed manner. This is true of all types of pain, mental, physical, emotional, even imagined. Each is doing its function to save the body. This is why God must act in the manner that we call jealous when he sees his creation heading towards an impending trap. Just as a lover guards his beloved and sets up bounds to protect her, so does God, the master in truth of the universe, hover over his cherished to guide us on to the truth of his singular existence. Just as a jealous lover will not tolerate another lover, so does God, the goal of love, not allow another to share his devotion. 75. Consider. What makes one person hear a word of Torah and understand, while another person pushes it away, saying, it's old-fashioned? What has happened in each person's life that makes one ripe while another is still green and hard? It's not merely intelligence, since many Jews with extremely high IQs, when exposed to the wisdom and beauty of the Torah, consider it nonsense or simply superstition. One person reads King David's songs and is awestruck, while his neighbor prefers contemporary love songs. One meets Abram, our father, through reading the Torah, and beams with joy that his great-great-grandfather was such a righteous person. He sits and reads the words over and over, like a separated lover hearing from his beloved, until the words are committed to memory. Then, throughout the day, while walking in traffic or sitting alone, he recalls his ancestor, Abram, the father of nations, with warm waves of love. Tears of thanks for having been given such a rich heritage will well up in his eyes, and then he will commit himself to a life of following the Torah's precepts, of learning and doing what God has deemed correct for a descendant of Abraham. Meanwhile, the majority of Jews in his generation whizz by on their electric careers, climbing to the top of success, being held in the eyes of their peers, surpassing money, fame, and power, only in the end to fill the same empty grave as a pauper. Our sages tell us this world is like an antechamber before the world to come. Prepare now while you have time and facility. Do not wait, for one never knows when death will seal the book, and you will have to cash in your vouchers of deeds, good and evil. Do not believe for an instant that death is an escape and that you can run out on your creditors. Know that life is eternal, and that death is but another room. The one who can hear has been blessed. 76. Consider. In order to receive an inheritance, the beneficiary must step forward and claim his newly acquired property. To do so, he must identify himself as the heir, and he must take possession. So it is with the Torah. The Torah tells us that the Torah is the inheritance of the Jewish people. But to be an heir without claiming the inheritance will not give you the use of the property. Until you accept it as your own, you are like the son of a rich man who has wandered away, temporarily giving up his rightful place, while his treasures wait locked in the storeroom. 77. Consider, the stream moves towards its goal constantly, sometimes swiftly, sometimes slowly, always approaching its end. The trees reach for the light, turning open leaves upward. Fruit, when ripe, drops and rolls to a stop, awaiting a hungry bird or a consuming sun. Man grows old and rests. Even rocks that resist for centuries must ultimately crumble before their destiny. God is the pervasive force that is moving creation along. God is the mover, and He is the moving. He is the designer and director, leading the cast to its finale. He is the moved and the final rest. God is the one who has cast creation onward, onto its forward reach, and the one who is waiting to catch it in its end. The yearning of life to grow, the force of birth, the constant call of death, the all-inclusive plot, the individual's quest to recognize the whole, it is all God. 78. Consider a cup. Most people would say that a cup has two sides, the inside and the outside. But imagine the cup being formed from a ball of clay. While in the form of a ball, all would agree that the sphere has only one side, a single plane. Its surface, top and bottom, are merely the continuation of each other. What happens when we indent the ball to form a cup? It is still the same object with the same single side, but now the top is pushed in. So it is with all creation. It basically has one side which has been pushed into all of the forms that we see. 79. Consider, what do you seek? Each movement of your eyes, your hands or feet, each reach of your mind or tongue, all that you yearn for from before conception and even past the final grave, has been and will be for one basic need, a single reason. Fulfilling life's needs for air, water, food, or love, for warmth, curiosity, or satisfaction, pride, or humility, all satisfy the same basic urge to progress. We're moving toward a goal. Through life, much like a freight train passes through a country, starting here and ending there, picking up baggage and dropping off goods, all the time tooting a whistle, chugging forward, winding mountains, trailing valleys, always moving toward the common goal. We, in effect, choose before we come to life which parents we will have, which opportunities we will be presented with, what lives we will lead, even the face that we will wear. We see the advantage and disadvantages of being born, and that by coming into life, we will improve our eternity. We used up all our merit in the spiritual world and paid for our sins, and we waited a seemingly endless wait for the redemption. We sat still, uncalled, and felt we would never get any closer. Then the opportunity came. Our number was called, and we looked down from the spiritual world and saw our entire life, its joys and its sorrows, its merits and its sins. Although we knew that we would be up against difficult things in the physical world and feared the possibility of failure, our previous actions caused the decree to descend to come upon us. We accepted the challenge, deciding the pain of living in the physical world was well worth the chance to melt the seemingly endless freeze. So with that yearning, we moved toward being born again, knowing that it was a temporary move, but hoping to return to the spiritual world with at least one good deed more than the errors we would collect. We saw the tears and the joys. They seemed like mere paper while we awaited our bodies. We saw that we would become attached to the physical again, attached to the body, the world, and the perspective of ego, the personal experience. We knew that we would forget the spiritual truth. This is a prerequisite to birth. But with all its vanities and failures, we had a hope, a prayer. We somehow believed that we would awaken while sleeping in the physical world and return to the spiritual world with abundance of merit, of kindness spent, of fulfilling God's precepts, and then we would rest. While in the womb, we learned Torah with an angel. Even though we were born naked, we try to take some imprints with us to help recall the true nature of our descent into worldly life. Any clue to why this life is so precious? The smallest precept could serve as a life-saving guardrail, saving us from a potential fall. A light at the end of a darkened hall. We are born crying and we die in silence. Crying befits what we face, and silence can be the only answer as we ascend and face the all-knowing judge who opens the book and reads. 80. Consider. The mind is a powerful judge. Whatever predisposition the mind has will be what the viewer sees. While the mind is positively disposed, the viewer, which is the I, experiences life positively. When the mind is being negative, the I will also generally react negatively. A lazy or indifferent I will be swept along following the mind's leanings. The I, however, can control the mind. Imagine walking down a street experiencing everything as positive. Birds singing, sun shining, the fresh air clean upon your face. All in all, you experience a general feeling of well-being. A few minutes later, you turn around and head back down the same street, struck by the depressing scene. Bird droppings, glare of the sun, cold air on your skin. All in all, you feel terrible and wonder why you even got out of bed that morning. What had happened? It's the same street, the same day, even the same hour. Why the change in mood? What happened is a shift in outlook. Some impression, even slightly negative, came to mind. This thought was added to the other unclear or negative impressions of the moment. Although it may have been a small feeling of little importance, it tipped the scale toward the negative. Taking its lead from the mind, the eye is dragged along, seeing everything in a negative light. When the mind was positive, the eye was also dragged along, but it did not complain. However, when the mind turns bleak, the eye begins to become bothered, which adds to the negativity. There are things to do to improve the mind's disposition. It need not be left to chance. The techniques are not difficult, but one must practice them diligently. The first step is to realize that all the colorings, the attitudes, the judgments are being formulated by the mind and are not actually found in the object itself. In fact, since the mind must draw upon its personal reservoir in order to label what it sees, it, in truth, is only judging itself. Next, realize that you are saying, "my mind." Therefore, there are two aspects or functions being spoken of here, the my and the mind. Recognizing this will allow the my, which is the I, to step back, especially at times of judgments, and temporarily divorce itself from the persistently judging mind. Once breathing space has been established, this is the space between the my and the mind, the rest is merely practice. Watch and see how the mind tries to color. Catch it saying, "that's an ugly thing," or "he's a bad person," and so on. If you feel yourself being drawn into agreement, seemingly at one with that opinion, then simply and calmly think something nice about that thing or about anything. When you succeed in this, you will realize the wisdom of not eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and you will be on your way toward re-entering the Garden of Eden. Along with this technique, there are many easy things to do to reinforce a newly positive mindset. Chassidus teaches that melodies will remove one from negativity. Every area of life should be investigated, and wherever there is a source of friction, it should be dealt with in a sensible way. Diet should be agreeable, friends should be positive, entertainment should be wholesome. Plain common sense will tell you to stay away from negative things, but it's up to you to follow what is right. Our lives are ours to control. We are not slaves subject to random perversity, we make our lives. We're allowed to order whatever we want, but whatever we order, we have to eat. 81. Consider. Why are the righteous swept away with the unrighteous? When a person steps on a tack and does not take care of it, the infection moves up the leg. Why should the leg be made to suffer for something that the foot did? Obviously, the body is one, and the entire body must reap the rewards and punishment as one. The man stepped on the tack, and the infection and swelling is spreading in the man. Had he tended to the foot in the first place, the leg would not have needed to suffer. So it is with all mankind. We are responsible for each other, and we will suffer even if our only sin is not being our brother's keeper. 82. Consider. Escorting the Queen. Malava Malka, Shabbos, the Holy Bride, descended upon us, permeating the day with holiness. A holiday was declared in her honor, and for over 24 hours the slaves had been set free. A day set aside for feasting and praise, for learning and resting. But now the earth has turned its back to the sun and has brought to a close the respite from the mundane. To inaugurate her arrival, we kindled two Shabbos candles, one to remember and one to observe. The clear glow encircling the flame was a joyful reminder of her presence. Now, as the time of separation comes, as the Queen of Days departs, we light a torch, a specially entwined candle woven from several thin candles, to light her way. Before extinguishing this torch, we light two candles from it in order to carry on the holiness still further. This is the light of the Malava Malka. It provides a weaning from the full rest of Shabbos to a partial rest. It is a time for music, words of Torah, sweets and friendship, a time to delve into the depths of the mystical, all designed to thwart the forces of sorrow that would sweep into the void left by the bride's departure. Songs drift upward, but still we cannot help but pine for the day when Shabbos will not go away again. 83. Consider. When laying tefillin, there are seven wrappings of the strap between the elbow and the wrist. These wrappings may be spaced equally, or they may, as some do, be placed in sections, writing a message upon the arm. This message, which is an additional reminder of his wisdom, can read Aleph, which is 1, Beit, 2, Dalet, 4, on the upper side of the forearm, and then Gimel, which is 3, and Dalet, which is 4, on the underside of the forearm. When Moses' arms fell, Israel appeared to be losing the battle against Amalek. When Moses' arms were raised up, Israel won the battle. What this means is that when a Jew relies on his own capabilities, that is, when his arm is down, Israel will not succeed in this battle. However, when Israel raises its arms to God, thereby recognizing God as the power of the world, Israel will succeed in the worldly battle. Aleph Beit Dalet, that we see when the arm is down, spell lost. When we pray with the tefillin arm and our arms are down, we see the message lost. When, however, we raise up our arms in prayer, as it says in the Torah, lift up your arms in holiness, we see written on the other side of the forearm the message Gimel Dalet, which spells good fortune. When we hold our arms up, when we rely upon God, indeed good fortune has come. The same principle may be seen when we are being bitten by snakes in the wilderness. Moses was told to make a copper serpent and suspend it on a pole. Then, when we would look at it, we would be healed from the serpent's bites. The Talmud explains that we should not think that the copper serpent had any independent power, but that by looking up, by relying upon God, God would effect a healing. 84. Consider. It was in the middle of what was to be called the Six-Day War. The jeep was speeding toward the Suez Canal when Moshe yelled from the back seat, "My tefillin fell out!" The driver whipped into a U-turn to retrieve them. The familiar screech pealed overhead, followed instantly by an earth-shaking explosion. The soldiers looked back through the dust to see a giant hole right where, had they not turned to retrieve the tefillin, the jeep would have been. 85. Consider. He had just received his draft notice to report for his physical. It was the Korean War, and although he had no particular feelings or great desire to serve some extremely distant cause, he felt that he should go. As a religious Jewish student, he could have easily claimed exemption until his rabbinical studies were completed, but he felt that his influence could very well do some good with the American soldiers. His immediate problem was his beard. Most authorities allow the removing of the beard with an instrument other than a razor, a scissors, for instance, but he chose to write the Rebbe for his answer. The Rebbe wrote back that under no conditions was he to even trim his beard, and while he was in the army, he was to be extremely careful to follow the Jewish law, especially the law relating to the washing of the hands. He felt it would be impossible to keep his beard with army regulations as they were, but he loved the Rebbe and went forward with his instructions in mind. To his utter surprise, no one ever commanded him to shave. After basic training and a short leave, he found himself in Korea on a patrol headed north. He was surprised how quickly one became accustomed to what just a few days ago was unthinkable. Every inch of the terrain was different than any he had ever seen, and he was acutely aware that behind every bush and rock, death was waiting. It was hard, but he kept up. By early afternoon, he was exhausted and wondering if his little patrol had been assigned a task of walking all the way to Manchuria. It was time to stop for the night. He had plopped down amongst his buddies for his normal fare of sea rations. He pulled out his canteen to wash before eating and saw that it was already three-quarters empty. There was no way he wanted to use up his precious water on his hands. He recalled a tiny stream some ways back and, remembering the Rebbe's advice, picked himself up and dragged along to the trickling stream. As he washed his hands, artillery fire and screams filled the silent countryside. He ran back to the campsite only to find death strewn about. He alone survived the attack. The hostilities ended shortly thereafter, and he returned to civilian life. Now people say, if you want to have a religious experience, watch this rabbi wash his hands. 86. Consider. Tzitzis are the fringes tied onto a man's four-cornered garment. The command to wear tzitzis is found in the Torah itself, but the method of tying tzitzis and the many other customs regarding their use are found in other books, such as The Reason of Customs. One such tradition is the prohibition of cutting tzitzis with a metal tool. Some say the reason for this is that tzitzis are a reminder of all 613 commandments, which will lead to peace. Since metal can easily be used as a tool for war, it has been deemed that we should not cut off our tzitzis with it, as we would be hinting that war will cut off our peace. There's also a custom that says tzitzis may be cut with glass, an unlikely weapon of war. But there's an even more interesting custom that says if you must cut them, it is better to cut them with your teeth. That is, bite them off. The proof cited for this tradition is that there are a total of 32 strands of tzitzit hanging from a garment, and a total number of teeth found in a normal adult is also 32. 87. Consider. The speech of the dead. How can the dead speak, since it says in the Torah, the dead cannot praise you? The dead speak through their children and the mitzvahs that they did during their lifetime. This is also how a departed soul can be elevated, not by its own speech, for it says, who can stand before him, but by the continuation of the deeds that he began during his lifetime on earth. 88. Consider, if we could see the ultimate outcome of our actions, would we act as we do? Who would choose the short-lived joy of a momentary fling if they knew that a horrible crash followed? We all do. The cigarette smoker knows that disease is the ultimate result of giving into that addiction. The impulse to lie or cheat or outright steal might give some false sense of momentary improvement or pleasure, but does the thief truly think that he will escape the inevitable repercussions that time will bring? No. Time is like a guillotine. It's directed by the past, and none escape its swoop. It says, consider the loss incurred by the performance of a good deed against the reward earned by its observance, and the gain derived from a sin against the loss that will follow. 89. Consider, all people have the same basic desires, a peaceful life, health, success, spiritually and physically, joy, family, friends, etc. How is it, then, that mankind cannot live in peace? One person's peace does not lessen another's. On the contrary, the more peaceful people there are in a city, the easier it becomes for all of its inhabitants to find peace. Therefore, it becomes incumbent upon us to seek the welfare of all people in order to ensure our own well-being. It is an indisputable fact that the least little kindness extended to another will return many times over to the giver. Can there be any better reason for an unfortunate person to extend himself? There is no better way to heal one's personal problem than to help those who need. 90. Consider, the Balagala has a special place in the heart of the Hasidus. Almost always an uneducated, colorful man of faith, the simple life of the wagon driver hid the unique personal relationship he enjoyed with his creator. The Baal Shem Tov would, without warning, instruct his Balagala to ready the horses for an emergency trip to save some helpless Jew. Once loaded, the Baal Shem Tov would instruct the Balagala to let go of the reins and let the horses lurch forward, chasing after the Baal Shem's spiritual desire. This act of letting go symbolizes the great faith endowed upon the simple driver. He allowed his only possession, his source of livelihood, the horses and wagon, to be led without control, completely trusting his Rebbe. Not many today are willing to surrender all that they possess to serve their Creator, let alone a servant of the Creator. This humble man's reward was often the witnessing of many miracles and a special leniency denied more educated followers. One day, a few years ago, a poor Balagala was noticing how tattered his sittis had become. A new pair cost $18. A large sum for a person with little funds. In his frustration, he lifted his eyes and said, "Okay, Hashem, if you want me to wear tzitzit, you get them for me, because I don't have the money." That afternoon, the Balagala was accompanying someone into a butcher shop, which he had never visited before. As soon as the butcher saw him, he called him over to the counter and pulled out a small paper sack. Opening it, he said to the driver, "Here, these are for you." He pulled out a brand new pair of tzitzits. The Balagala's face beamed. He looked at his presents from God and wore them day and night for years until they became skimpy, bare threads, and at last he had to retire them to his trunk, a holy souvenir sent to him directly from God Almighty, who has time for even the simplest request from the simplest of people. 91. Consider. It was Friday night, and the Balagala was helping to set up the community festive meal. The time for Kiddush had come, and those who had no table of their own gathered around the community table to enjoy a meal provided by the collections made by the rabbi. The challah was not covered, and the rabbi yelled for the balagala to quickly run into the storeroom and grab the challah cover so the service could begin. He ran quickly as he could into the storeroom and found a dark mess. Not only had someone neglected to leave the room lighted, but that afternoon a large shipment had been delivered, so he found himself in a pitch-black, cluttered maze. He was pressed and bewildered. After several minutes of stumbling over the strewn boxes and bumping against the cluttered piles, he realized his foul. Looking up, he called out, "What am I doing? You can see even in the dark." Immediately, his hand shot out uncontrollably into the darkness and his fingers closed around something soft. He grabbed it, turned, and ran back into the lighted room. He looked down to see what was in his hand, a challah cover. A smile lighted his face. His eyes shone and danced as he ran to the head of the table and covered the challah so the rabbi could sanctify the day. 92. Consider. There are problems you feel as if you are grabbing, and there are problems that feel like they are grabbing you. Actually, these are the same problems in different stages of intensity. Although what may seem to be like a small bother is not worth troubling oneself about, the large, glaring problems always draw our attention. But we must learn our lessons from the smaller problems so that they need not grow. A problem such as a person saying something bad about you is indeed less important than being laid up in bed. But actually, the latter could easily be an outgrowth of the former, since both are really symptoms of something that we did. Whatever happens to us in life, whether it is pleasurable or disturbing, occurs with reason. Since this is so, we should be able to learn how to improve from any given event. If it is illness, one must, of course, follow the doctor's advice. But the doctor does not know the spiritual reason why this particular sickness came. In order to learn this, one must search one's deeds and then turn from the negative action. One may also have to pay damages and ask forgiveness before going on. Although there are definite dangers in drawing conclusions without complete understanding, still, a calm and orderly appraisal of one's deeds should lead to a constructive appraisal of one's life. Beware of the overly active guilt response. Such a response causes one to neglect the immediate problem and creates a secondary problem of depression due to guilt, a new complication. As discussed above, guilt has a proper place in the universe and should be used constructively. In the case of someone speaking ill of you, even if what they said was obviously untrue, why were those very words chosen to be sent to you? The fact that someone spoke ill of you is enough reason to examine your life. Tracing those very words can give you more specific information of how you erred. If a soft message is ignored, it is guaranteed that a more severe message will follow. For example, when Pharaoh chose to ignore the first plague, Hashem sent a second, more severe one. Then again and again, until Pharaoh caused his own death by refusing to heed the initial soft voice. Although we are cautioned not to follow signs and wonders, it is also well known that God does not smite the foot for the hand's transgression. Every dot in the universe is here for a reason. There are no accidents or mistakes in creation. If a mosquito bites your hand, it is for a reason. Even the wind does not blow by chance, as many would believe, but by explicit design. Again, the problem comes when someone with extremely limited vision tries to trace divine reason, or even worse, follows the ways of the many types of idolatries found throughout the ages, such beliefs as bread fell from his mouth, so he'll have such and such a day. Or, a deer crossed his path, so he must change directions. These are actual historical practices that are extremely dangerous and can easily lead to madness. Such absurdities are the foundations of many superstitious religions and have been instrumental in feeding many centuries of darkness covering a huge portion of the face of the earth. When evaluating one's bumps and bruises, go slowly and try to move away from pain. Look at your behavior and then try to compare it to the truly great sages of your generation. Try to align your life to theirs. This should assure you a more pleasant journey. 93. Consider. When you see someone with egg on his face, first check your face and then gently inform him of his problem. 94. Consider. What is the light of understanding? It is not a directed light, such as sunlight, coming from a source and then proceeding outward to lighten a distant object. Such a light illuminates only what is in its unobstructed path. Any obstruction will create a shadow behind it. The light of understanding is not like this. It does not allow shadows to be created in its field. It is called light only by analogy, but in truth it is a revealer of light, more akin to spiritual than physical illumination. For example, light comes in through a dusty window dimly. When the window is cleaned, more light enters. This cleaning of the glass is quite like the light of understanding. Although it is not a light itself, it allows light to enter. So it is with the enlightenment of the mind. There's no flashlight shining in the dark corners of the mind, but rather the removal of ignorance that was blocking the truth from being recognized. Once the ignorance or false concepts have been removed, only the enlightened experience will remain. What we experience now in this world is the ever-present light being formed into creation. This pure light is concealed in order to project the appearance of form. Were it not concealed, form could not appear. Its concealment is accomplished by allowing the appearance of color and distinction. Now we see objects as physical objects due to this concealment. In the later days, the days of the Mashiach, as the concealment lessens, we will see these objects as both physical and as radiating light. As the prophet told us, the sun shall be no more your light by day, neither for brightness shall the moon give light, for the Lord shall be your everlasting light. This world will be a land, a time, without shadows, as light will radiate from all. As the prophet said, and thy days of mourning shall be ended. How does this help us now? To conceive of nature as basically light will help us to detach from its solely physical appearance and allow us to begin to perceive the physical aspects spiritually. 95. Consider. Knowing spiritually is different than knowing through the senses. Physically, we're able to see only what actually touches our eyes and proceeds into our brain. Although we think we are seeing something in front of us, what we really see is its reflection on our eyes passed into our brain as perceived by the mind. All depth that we envision is created by the mind adjusting these reflections, not by the eyesight traveling to the object being viewed. For instance, a building appears to be shorter at the far end, but if we would travel to the far end of that building, it would not appear so. Although it seems that we travel into the depth of creation to touch something, even these sensations are all mind-created, and what we experience is quite different from what is actually there. A distant noise travels to the ear, which affects the final sound. One hears the sound change, when in fact, only additional sounds have been added. These distortions are required in order to live in the physical world. But we know that all physical perceptions come from the mind and do not necessarily express accurately what is here. Then this world that we are so familiar with, do we really know what it is? Spiritual seeing is quite different. The mind does not have to deal with the physical distortions. When it knows spiritually, the mind is formulated into the object being revealed, and for all intents and purposes, has actually become that object or message. As such, the mind projects itself in front of the I am, which experiences being that object, distortion-free. Even though the sensations coming to us through the senses are, at best, distorted, this does not mean that we should reject this information and try to leave the physical world. But it does show us that what we see and hear all day is not an unaltered truth. There are greater revelations to be gleaned from this life than what the senses feed the mind. Such recognition is a step towards spiritual thinking, which will help release us from the trap of being caught up in a completely physical world where physical objects rule life and death is seen to be the end of existence. 96. Consider, the pulls of the physical world are natural and constant. In the Bible, it was a famine that forced Yaakov to rely on and ultimately to go down into Egypt. Even if we wish to sit still and concentrate on the spiritual aspects of life, as the natural pangs of hunger come upon us, we must actively seek food, which forces us to come into the physical limitations. Egypt in Hebrew means physical limitations. This can be done as an animal trampling all in order to satisfy a raging appetite, or in a way that uplifts the individual, the community, and even the physical food. By shaping the purely physical need into a holy service, we are assuring that our bodies will not be buried there in limitation in Egypt, and that we will be carried up and out into the Holy Land. Allegorically, this explains that by coming out of formlessness into the physical, limited world, with a consciousness of divine service, we will be ensured that our essence will not remain buried in these limitations forever, but will again be set free into the spiritual redemption. To live solely in a physical world eradicates the distinction between man and beast. 97. Consider, how many of us would love to change something that we have done in the past, but alas, it's become too late. Perhaps the most familiar case is the sudden death of a loved one, and we say, if only I had known this was going to happen, I would have done something to patch up our relationship before he died. If only I had known. How foolish we are to forget that death is here and that at any moment our fate could become sealed. If we would regret having neglected to say something to someone before they die, then we by all means must seek them out now and say it. For who knows the hour of their passing? And if we need to consider what we have to say to our loved ones, how much more so do we need to talk to our Creator and Judge while we still have the breath to speak and the time to turn? Is not this relationship even more important? 98. Consider. An angel seems to go about on one leg, while man goes about on two. The angel's legs touch each other, giving a unified appearance. Man strides about the earth with both legs. Does this mean that he is better than an angel? Well, in some ways, yes. An angel is sent forth without choice, only one leg. It must go where it has been told to go, doing exactly as it has been commanded. Man can step to the right or to the left, doing his own choosing. This allows man the rewards, but also the punishments of free will. The angel is sent to the world to do a specific job. Its existence is fixed. Man has the ability to be involved with many tasks at one time. Man can improve his life, present and eternal. 99. Consider. The length of time normally allotted to a man today is approximately 70 or 80 years. If we consider this entire span, we must adjust our lives accordingly. For instance, if we think only of the moment, we could easily become lazy or overeat or do any number of foolish things that we call short-sighted. But when we consider the broader picture, we do not waste time, but rather plan our lives so that we save during our most productive years for our retiring years. Such long-range planning is not possible for the short-sighted person. But now consider the span of life to be eternal. The productive years, the years in the body, where there are choices that produce results, which affect the future, are seen to be very short, merely 70 or 80 years out of thousands or millions of years for each person. It quickly becomes obvious that we must use our productive time wisely in order to ensure a wonderful forever. 100. Consider. When Yaakov ben Mazel Tov sat by the kotel, the holiness of the place was manifest through his blessings. The sweetness of his presence was so bright that the great ones around him paled in comparison. The loss caused by his passing is immense. The hole created by his absence cannot be filled. When we look at the place where he sat, we cannot help but feel a void, an emptiness, where once there was a blessing. While this great tzaddik sat by the kotel, another great and humble man sat a short distance away. Now those looking for a blessing go to him. The same light that we lost when Yaakov ben Mazel Tov passed has illuminated this holy person. And although we cannot compare the succeeding generation to the previous one for greatness, we're not lost. We have a blessing in every generation, as it says, "And you shall go to the judges in your day." 101. Consider. God's most holy name, which is usually translated as Lord, Eternal, or God, comes from the word existence, or cause to be. This shows us that existence is God. The one that exists in all, as all, is God. As Chassidus tells us, God is all, and all is God. Obviously, one side of an equation must equal the other side of the equation, no matter which is stated first. So why bother stating this both ways? God is all emphasizes God, the unmanifest, is all that there really is. This stresses the only one existence is the Holy One, God Almighty. Hearing this alone, we could conclude that we and our experiences do not exist. Therefore, we must also hear, all is God. All this, the manifest, apparent, many, is also God. Even after seeing that He is all, we still face everyday problems. We do not eradicate the perspective of worldly living. So even after hearing that the Holy One is all that there is, we hear again, the all is also the Holy One. 102. Consider. There are millions of people today walking around in a darkened hell. Their minds weigh heavily as they drag through their day, wishing it were time to go back to sleep, to escape. Their hell is as real as the joy and smile of the optimist. They have been trapped in the dark corners of their minds, and they have forgotten the joy and simplicity of their youth. They awaken in darkness and do not escape for a moment. Yet all this hell can be relieved, and the captives can go free. The prisoners can throw off their dreariness, songs and smiles can alight upon their lips. Their dungeons can be opened, light can sweep away the cobwebs and shadows, and this can be accomplished without an immense amount of effort. When worrisome thoughts multiply within me, your consolation delights my soul. Here, with these words, King David explains the way. The light of holy thoughts can brighten even the darkest hell. The same person in the same day can emerge himself in darkness or in light. Each of us chooses his surroundings, mental and physical. The simplest, pure thought will be rewarded, and it will also lead to another enlightening thought, until at last there will be more light than darkness, and the slave will be redeemed. 103. Consider. Every Jew is a survivor. Those who lived through the horrors of the death camps and those who are not yet born share this grace of being survivors of God's wrath and man's dementedness. Viewed with a narrow mind, only hate and horror is the fruit of those perverted years when torture was the norm and man sunk to unbelievable depths. No nightmare ever dreamed can compare to the hell that was served to us. Yet despite the horror of it, the truth is, we brought it on ourselves. We caused each crime by previously committing the acts required to bring such bitter fruit. Many of us refused to bind his words upon our arms as a sign. So we were forced to wear yellow stars or tattooed numbers or other degrading signs to reveal our Jewishness. As callous as it seems, we must know that not only were we forced to dig our own graves physically, but first we dug our own graves by committing the transgressions that resulted in the enemies being able to force us to submit to such horrors. This in no means absolves them for their role, as God chooses evil people to do evil in the world. Nor does this condemn all those who perished as transgressors. In many places, we see the community being punished for the errors of a few. It is well known that the Jewish people are treated as one body. For each transgression, there is a punishment. We caused what came, and even our righteous were punished. Perhaps they could have done more to stop us from assimilating, or perhaps they were taken from us as a further punishment for our not having listened to them. Certainly none alive today can completely see the exact cause and effect of each action, but we can see that God is just, and we do know that there are no accidents. We do know that the Jews of Europe, especially Germany, were compromising the Torah, and we do know that throughout it all, we survived to build a land which we had previously rejected. None can comfort such a wound. But even after such a horrible pruning, the orchard has survived and is in fact blooming. 104. Consider. Jewish meditation can be experienced in three stages. First, one can experience the mind delving into a particular Torah thought. For example, the Torah says, there is no other. Reach into this concept. Try to understand what is being said. What are its implications? How does this change daily life? What is the physical world if there is no other? Go deeper and deeper, stretching the limits of understanding. This stage of meditation may be done without interfering with the normal daily physical activities. The next stage of Jewish meditation is the most familiar form of meditation, but perhaps the least tapped. Herein lies the greatest opportunity for rapid gain, but also the most subtle, and therefore this stage must be guarded carefully. This is the stage of the mystical Ayin. God creates the universe, something from nothing, Yesh Me'ayin. This can be understood by examining a physical object, such as a table. The table is really there, but as we delve into its composition, we see molecules, then atoms, then space, then place. As we go deeper and deeper, we transcend each physical realm until at last we come to place, which is the unmanifest, the no thing. If God created the universe from something, then as we delve deeper into any object, ultimately we would have to come to that something. But since the universe is created from nothing, ultimately there must be nothing. This is the concept of something created from nothing. The most common way to meditate in this stage is with the Shema. This thought is perhaps the most often quoted central theme of Judaism. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Close your eyes and say the Shema. Shema Yisrael. Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. The eyes are closed to emphasize the formlessness of the ultimate and to prevent fixing upon an object which could lead to idolatry. There are 25 letters in the Shema. The numerical value of God's name is 26. We prepare by saying the 25 letters in order to reap the benefits that follows, which is the unspoken 26th. Without saying the 25 letters, we will not realize the completion of the 26th. This also teaches that the physical world cannot be ignored in favor of the formless, as this would not produce the desired completion. The Shema also has six words. These are likened to the six working days of the week. We spend these days engaged in the preparations for the Shabbos. Here too, in this stage of meditation, we say these six words as a preparation for the Shabbos that follows. We say the words out loud distinctively, emphasizing the final Echad. Then rest. In this rest, this space is the essence of this stage of meditation. Following this rest, say to yourself, "Blessed be His glorious kingdom forever and ever." This is your re-entry back into form, back into the daily world. This is your prayer to open your eyes and see this world as His glorious kingdom forever and ever. Now for the third and final stage of Jewish meditation. This encompasses the previous two stages, but also adds a most glorious crown of holy life possible. This is the final goal of the previous two stages. This is the day of Shabbos itself. In the first stage, we delved into reason. We worked hard to try to understand. We searched and argued, we grasped and grabbed. Over and over we tried to gain the fullest understanding intended in the Torah. In the second stage, we blissfully floated in the realm of Ayin, the peaceful no-thing that approaches His Holy of Holies. Now in the third stage, we take this knowledge and this brief pause, and we combine them with time, space, the physical, and the spiritual. The time is the seventh day. The space is the synagogue and the home. The physical is family, friends, and food. The spiritual is recognized by the benefit brought about by the world of prayer, blessing, and songs of praise. This is the crown of the Torah. This is the peak of life intended to be lived in the body. This day is the teacher, the day of rest set aside for praising the blessed Creator. Herein lies the secret of the Torah and Jewish meditation. The day, and ultimately the week, become the meditation. Just as the six words of the Shema are part of the meditation in the second stage, so is everything we do during the week to prepare for the Shabbos part of the meditation in the final stage. As we go through our week, earning, buying, cooking, or cleaning, if our intention is to prepare for Shabbos, we are in fact as much involved in the meditation of the Shabbat as we were when saying the six words of the Shema. Finally, we see that in order for a meditation to become successful, it cannot end when we stand up or open our eyes, but must increase our peace throughout our lives. If we are satisfied with merely 20 minutes of peace in the morning and another 20 minutes at night, like those who meditate only at these times, we might as well just sleep a little longer. Instead, Jewish meditation is successful when Shabbos is seen to be the crown of days and that its preparations throughout the week are also holy experiences. This is the sole purpose of any meditation, to enjoy the clarity and peace that is revealed in rest. Thereisone.com